I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you. To learn all about the things that matter most, I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. Hi.
I sure am Tom Merritt. Hey. And Scott Johnson,
yeah.
The only thing I'm more excited about than today's Current Geek is the fact that it's Current Geek before Nerdtacular.
Whoa. And next week's Current Geek, which will occur, will happen live on Saturday at the
like
proceedings.
Like a baby alien, Current Geek will come from within Nerdtacular.
Whoa. I don't like thinking of it in those terms.
We will burst out of the chest of Nerdtacular.
Yeah, we still don't exactly know what it's going to be, but obviously it'll involve a lot of you who are going and maybe even some callers from outside. We're still working on that, making that happen at the event. But yeah, coming up, big event, big stuff, and that show will be on the feed, so don't you worry, everyone at home.
We could do it like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Like, name a story, and then we just talk about it.
Yeah, I like this idea. We have a guest. We always have a guest. We love having guests. And our guest today is Matt Whalen, working for Industrial Light and Magic for years and years and years. Later worked on the Matrix sequels, Hellboy, Constantine, Call of Duty, Black Ops. He is the co-host of the VFX show podcast for FX Guide and a full member of the Visual Effects Society. Matt, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you very much.
I feel like we
I was super excited. I was just going to say, I was really excited more than anything to meet Gavel McLeod. Is he here?
Gavel is very excited to meet you as well.
Tom, does he get extra points for that because he knows the name and remembered it?
Yeah, I think he starts off with 50 points.
All right. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks good. I sort of thought he might have some googly eyes and a little captain's hat, though.
No, we're not nearly as cool.
While on duty.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, he wouldn't have a captain's hat on duty, but sometimes he likes to relax that way.
Not quite as forward-thinking on that stuff, but it's cool to have an actual professional effects guy, and we talk so much about movies and the things we like and the... you know, where movie tech has gone in the last few years, and to have somebody here who's, you know, hands-on with that stuff is pretty neat. So thanks for being on with us, man.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it is time for us to now scale the great heights of the headlines.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Prove it, Tom.
Well, Matt, along with Hobbit from PA and Star Fury Zeta, all were impressed by this story. An 18 feet long, 12 feet wide Millennium Falcon that Hot Toys is planning to show off at the Anacom and Games Convention in Hong Kong. It's a 1/6 scale, full-on Millennium Falcon. They showed off a 1/6 scale cockpit at Comic-Con, but they're going for the whole Millennium Falcon at Anacom and Games. And I think it's probably perfect for an Ewok and a very small solo.
Very small solos.
A 1/6 size solo.
Do we know this isn't for sale so much as it is to just show it off, or are they going to sell it?
Confusion reigns. They're definitely using it for their booth at the con, and they're just not saying whether that would ever be for sale or not.
Mm. So Matt is a guy who works in actual special effects, and you've, you know, done things with ships, be they, you know, CG-driven or practical. This kind of stuff, these kinds of props, must be interesting to you. You probably collect this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I don't really collect much of that kind of stuff, but I mean, I've seen many of the real actual models from the movies I did when I started at Lucasfilm a long time ago. I was an intern when I started. I was still in undergrad, and I got to take a tour of the archives at the ranch, and they had a bunch of that stuff there. It was cool, but I just thought this was such a crazy story. Like, I can't imagine what you'd do with it.
Yeah.
Other than
you
like
need
just
a,
like
you,
a
you need
thing
a big space, right? Like a giant a basement that would have enough space in it to kind of keep that thing in there, I guess.
Yeah, Gizmodo suggested getting an apartment for the Falcon.
That wouldn't be cheap or expensive at all. Not a problem. But it's big enough to, like, if you had, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Let's say you had a warehouse-sized place that was either your place of business or something, and you had high ceilings.
It's like one of those live work loft things.
Sure.
Right? You got high ceilings, bed over in a corner, forklift in the other.
Yeah, and then just steel cord these things from the ceiling and have that thing hanging above everything and lit and stuff. Oh man, like that's my I would do that in a heartbeat if I had the wherewithal to make something like that happen. But honestly, what else are you going to use it for? I do feel like at some point, if they make these either custom for special orders or whatever, they're going to be in the 10 to 20,000 range. It's my thinking.
Oh, at least.
Yeah. At the very least,
it's the kind of thing that just made me think. Like, you know, reminds me of being like a little kid in the 70s and like playing with like the little the little Kenner Millennium Falcon, you know, cool. Like a kid could just like, it would blow a kid's mind, you know, playing with something that was that scale. Yeah.
That Kenner Millennium Falcon was huge.
Yeah.
At that age, right? Can you imagine? Totally.
Still have that somewhere in some box. I don't know where I put it, but but yeah, I think it's for the very rich and the very well space endowed.
It's just going to be in their booth. Do you guys really think they would sell these?
I don't know. There was some talk earlier in the week when I first saw this being talked about, and then there were these prices being bandied about, like $6,000 would be the cost of materials. So tack on top of that, whatever labor, and you know, some people were like trying to estimate this thing, and they were in the $15,000 range, and I think that was all just a bunch of guesswork, because in the end, I don't think they're selling this. It'll be like, you know, when Weta does their booth displays, they have giant orcs and, you know, huge recreations of cave trolls from Lord of the Rings or something. They're not selling those. So Tom's probably right. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking going on with people who have a lot of money to spend. That's what's happening.
But Captain Kipper points out a report from research firm Parks Associates that estimates that services like HBO Go, Netflix lose up to $500 million worldwide to people who share login information. 6% of U.S. broadband households use a service paid for by someone outside of the house. Services like HBO and Netflix responded with a collective shrug. Because they all know this happens. Netflix even has plans that let you do this, and they all feel like they're going to make more money by not fighting it and just providing reasons for people to want to pay than to go try to crack down on it.
Well, even now, so Netflix in the house now, if I'm on it, if I was on it right now and one of the kids was on it somewhere else on a TV or something, we're good. But the minute a third party tries to pop it up on their iPad or another television or screen, they get kicked out. So they have some limiting factors that way.
Yeah, they only allow, they're limiting the number of times you can be logged in, mm-hmm. but you can buy a 4 login at a time plan. It's $12.99, I think.
Yeah. And that's another, I mean, it's another example of them riding the trend rather than fight it.
It always seems to me too, like it's one of those things where it's like that old adage, you know, it doesn't matter what they're saying about you as long as they're talking about you. You know, there's something that kind of feels like that in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And HBO, I would say somewhat famously in the last couple of years, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, but it seems like they've taken this stance in a lot of ways. They, for example, famously know that Game of Thrones is the most torrented show on the internet. But they don't seem to get all that riled up about it. I guess if this stuff really, really hardcore dinged their bottom line, well, of course they'd say something.
Well, and that's where I find these estimates to be ridiculous. What they do is they say, how many people are sharing these logins that don't live in the household? Now take that number and multiply it by the subscription fee and call that the amount of money lost. And that's false. The fact is that these people who are sharing the logins probably wouldn't pay for it if they weren't sharing the login. They're sharing the login because they can't afford to pay for it themselves,
right,
or at least they don't want to have to. So they probably would, in many cases, just forego paying. So you're not really losing $500 million. And HBO understands that. They're looking at all of this stuff. And you're right. It's kind of cagey. They don't endorse it. They never say it's okay to pirate, which some people, you'll hear some people exaggerate what they've said. But they don't come down on it. They're like, well, I guess we can consider it a compliment. They're just very much trying to take the road of, we don't want to encourage bad behavior, but we also understand the marketplace out there, and we're going to do things that are going to positively make you want to pay us for our content rather than just go around with a gavel and try to stomp everything out.
It probably follows that, well, if HBO's smart and Netflix and others are smart, they had to have been paying attention during the real heyday of torrent being the great threat that it was, and the music business fighting it, and then later video fighting it. And they're all, in, for the most part, Johnny Come Lately's on the video scene. They came after all that upheaval, and they probably saw all that and learned from it, I would hope. You know, they saw that happen and went, well, everyone hates BMI, or they hate whoever. They hate Lars Ulrich from Metallica for hating Napster so much or whatever. And it created this bad blood that made people just pirate harder.
And which would you rather people get in the habit of?
Mm-hmm.
Logging into your product, even if it is your mom's login, and mm-hmm. getting used to that, and then someday going, well, wait, mom doesn't want to pay for it anymore, I guess I will. Or pirating, where HBO is nowhere involved in the transaction at all.
Yeah, I completely agree. That makes good sense to me. So, yeah, keep it up, HBO Go. And sorry about the 500 million.
HBO. Go. JMZ668 pointed out a Medium post written by Andres Iniestia, a man who lives in Madrid, who apparently likes to take pictures, quote, of his kids, yummy food, and interesting buildings. Oh. Sounds like an Instagrammer. In fact, he is. Last week, Instagram closed his account. All he was told is that he had been infringing on the terms of use. Iniestia contacted Instagram twice, got no response. A few days later, his Instagram followers noticed that a football player, soccer player named Andres Iniestia, same name, showed up in their feeds.
Oh, no.
So the original Iniestia contacted Instagram again, still got no response. He wrote a Medium post about the situation, and 5 hours later, his account was restored with no explanation. In the player's defense, the player's agent contacted the original Iniestia and said that they had nothing to do with the problem. They didn't know what happened.
So wait, is this Instagram? I mean, I'm trying not to see sinister behavior here, but is this basically them saying, well, this more famous football player should have that name, so we're shutting you down and giving it to him?
That's sounds like to me. It made me think, actually, seeing this story, it made me think of another story that I don't know if you guys are familiar with, but if you go to Nissan.com, right? It's actually the Nissan Computer Corporation, and there was a huge lawsuit over this. And so Nissan Motors, the car company, they actually sued this guy to try to get Nissan.com from him. And he actually, the Mr. Nissan who runs this computer company, he actually won. Like, he's like, hey, I'm Mr. Nissan. Why can't I have it? Why should you guys have it instead of me? And so now if you want to look up, at least in the United States, if you want to look up cars for Nissan, you have to go to NissanUSA.com. And I think in the end, it looks like, you know, they did the right thing. Like, they restored his account. But it's one of those things where, you know, they're looking at it and I'd imagine thinking that, you know, this is the real guy. He's going to be the verified kind of person with that name. And, you know, they hand it over to him and then somebody complains and they figure out, oh, maybe this isn't such a cool move. And they come back.
Yeah. They, I'm looking at that site now and man, someone should step up with some help here. It's an ugly site, but there's that age old thing is should preferential treatment be given to big brands with huge money, or should the internet continue to be this place where Joe Schmo can register AT&T.com and be able to keep it because he thought of it first or whatever. It's a bad example, but this Nissan guy is a good example of it. I'm on the side of this guy. He should be able to keep his domain, you know?
Well, it's not even a domain, right? It's an account on a social networking service. And so it's up to the social network. It's up to Instagram how they want to handle it. I think the best way for Instagram to handle it is to verify with the account holder, hey, can you show us that you're really Andres Iniestia? We're sorry to bother you, but it is the name of a famous football player. So, you know, we just want to verify that you are also that name. What it sounds like is instead they're like, so many spoof accounts out there. This guy, this joker probably stole the name and then just took it and then ignored him. And that's the part that makes me mad. It's not so much that they took it, which I think is wrong, but then when he complained about it, he couldn't get through to a person until he complained about it on the internet. And that, you know, that's just not the right way to run things.
No, I agree. I guess I'm glad he had the outlet at the end to have a place to do it on Medium and catch somebody's attention. But I still don't know. Like, and then to restore it without saying anything, I don't know. It's just bad form on their part. And I know it's a free thing and they can do what they want and all of those things. But, you know, if somebody, let's say a new Scott Johnson comes on the scene and becomes a huge, popular Tom Cruise level celebrity. Okay.
Right.
Hide your light under a bush.
That makes me a little nervous because that probably means that this person is going to go after my stuff. Then again, like, you know, Will Smith over at tested.com, he's got Will Smith on Twitter. And he has been bugged before to give that over to Will Smith, the actor, and wouldn't do it.
And let's be clear, the player's agent actually reached out and was like, wasn't us.
Yeah.
The player being a pushy celebrity. Instagram got in the way somehow.
And the way Tom usually puts it, this stuff usually works itself out. The system has a way of working itself out, and it did. But I'd still say poo-poo on Instagram for not being nicer about it.
Not being more responsive. Yeah. Hey, Matt, you flagged this cool FXGuide.com story about Lola VFX's de-aging the effects of Michael Douglas in Ant-Man, which was really impressive. It was also done for the skinny Steve Rogers in Captain America and Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen in X-Men.
Is it the same? Is it the same as the Benjamin Button stuff, or is this a different technology?
It is. Yeah, it's similar. I mean, the Benjamin Button stuff was, you know, obviously several years earlier, but it's really cool. The Lola visual effects supervisor is Trent Claus. I don't think he's related to Santa, but they've got their studio out in LA, and they've been really excelling at this type of work in particular. And I think it's one of the really, at least from my perspective, it's one of the really exciting things happening in visual effects when, you know, you have an actor like Michael Douglas, who I think is in his 70s now, and they're able to, you know, have him in sort of a flashback sequence within the context of the film and using really just brute force 2D compositing techniques, which is some of the hardest work, I think, in visual effects. Of course, I that's what I did for a long time, so I can say that. But which some people would probably disagree with me, but I think it's one of the harder things to do. And the work that they're able to, the kind of effects they're able to attain using the techniques that they've been developing, I think they just get better and better. If you go back and look at the Skinny Steve performance, which used a body double, but also a lot of compositing techniques to create the look of Skinny Steve in the first Captain America film. I mean, it's just so impressive to see Chris Evans' head on this really kind of scrawny little body. And then also with in the X-Men films, the flashback sequence with Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart looking so much younger. And then I think this Michael Douglas in Ant-Man, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, he really does look almost like the Michael Douglas, you know, maybe a few years, they said maybe around the Romancing the Stone era, you know, and there's a cool story over it on FX Guide, which are, you know, friends of mine too. But I just think it's so impressive. It's really exciting to see this kind of work. And I think you'll start to see this type of technique, and even though it's pretty complicated, you'll start to see this kind of matriculate out into, you know, consumer grade tools as well.
The stuff I read was really interesting because it talked about how the technique hasn't changed very much over the last decade and a half or even longer. It's just that everyone's getting better with it. Does that jive with you? Does that sound right?
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, the more of this kind of work that you do, the more you can kind of plan out how you want to do it. Where they'd had a stand-in that was a younger stand-in in the same lighting scenario, shooting the scene that Michael Douglas would shoot. And then they would have Michael Douglas go into the same scene, but they could take skin grafts and bits and areas and pieces off of the younger actor and also use other compositing tricks and other images of Michael Douglas from other films and kind of kludge together a face that winds up looking really just incredible on screen. I think there was just under 30 shots in that sequence in Ant-Man, and it's some of the most impressive work I've seen. It's every time I see that stuff, it's just amazing. It'd be really interesting if they got to a point where they felt confident enough that they could do a whole movie like that. Mm-hmm. You know, go back and have a film of, you know, Michael Douglas joked about doing the prequel to Romancing the Stone
or Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, my wife and I were talking about that, like how far away we are from an actor being able to say, well, it doesn't really matter how old I am. You could just make me whatever age you want. I mean, is how far off is that sort of idea from being able to be executed?
I mean, I think it can already be done. It's just a matter of, you know, it's a matter of cost, I think. And in terms of, you know, this technique that Lola did, it sounds like it's really just a lot of brute force work. I mean, I think it's many, many hours of really, you know, talented artists sitting at the box and like just busting it out. It seems like the kind of thing that, you know, we're probably a little ways away. There's a, and this is sort of a different technique than what you see in the Terminator Genesis. In Terminator Genesis, that's all about the digital human, right? And so the digital human project, where it's a completely 3D version of a young Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's a very different process than this kind of 2D solution of taking Michael Douglas. He's not a 3D character, but rather a 2D composite of many characters simultaneously.
So when they do that Arnold thing, that would be akin to like the Tron Legacy, the version of Jeff Bridges, right? Where he was
correct.
Sort of a 3D CGI version of his previous self, unlike this, which sounds, the more you describe it, the more it sounds like you're taking chunks of stuff and sticking it on him. I mean, it's almost like digital makeup instead of digital recreation.
Yeah, I think so. I think with all of the Lola's work in terms of de-aging, as well as with the I can't remember the actress's name now, the woman that plays Agent Carter.
Haley Atwell?
Correct, yeah. And they actually did a, in, was it the second movie or in the Avengers movie, where they had her actually age forward. And some of that was applique, like traditional makeup, but some of it was also the same technique, but going the other direction. So, you know, creating a sort of older version of that young actress.
I really like the subtlety of it and the fact that it doesn't jump out. The only reason you even notice it or catches you off guard isn't because you're having some uncanny valley. It's because you just know Chris Evans isn't that skinny. And
yeah,
and so there's some dissonance there. But if you'd never seen Chris Evans before and you saw him in that form, you just go, oh, skinny Chris, that's that actor's real skinny, how weird. And you wouldn't think, oh, those effects are terrible, or you know, there's the uncanny valley doesn't seem to exist in this technique, and that's pretty exciting. But it also makes sense to me that it's so labor intensive, because the hard stuff always is. So
yeah, did either of you guys see the Terminator Genesis?
I haven't seen it yet. No.
Oh, yeah, I was just curious. I mean, that's one where, you know, they have Schwarzenegger look like he did in the original Terminator.
Right.
And it's really impressive, I think. But it's one of those things where, you know, we were joking around about it, saying, well, you know, he sort of looks sort of rubbery and he kind of looks, you know, like a robot. But of course, you know, Schwarzenegger, like, I think, is known. Right. That's kind of his range as an actor, too.
And right? He's playing a robot. So,
yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
Wow.
You could fudge it and be like, oh, yeah, we meant it.
That's great. Yeah. Love it.
Another story that Matt noted is the 2015 Emmy nominations for Outstanding Main Title Design. And I don't know what it is, but lately I have been noticing titles more than I used to. I think it's because a lot of broadcast shows started to lose them because they were fighting against commercial time for a while. And it's nice to see them coming back. Elastic got nominations for Halt and Catch Fire, as well as Daredevil. Imaginary Forces got nods for Bosch, which is an Amazon series, and the show Manhattan. How do you say this, Matt? Is it YU plus Co, or do they have
I just thought it was UCO.
UCO. They got a nomination for Olive Kitteridge, and Prologue got their third nomination for American Horror Story Freak Show. The Emmy Awards are September 12th. And Matt, you were saying, like, it's kind of a lost art, and it's nice to see these.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I always loved like all those old Saul Bass animations. Like if you go back and watch Vertigo, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and the work that was done on that, and what's the other one? There's a great opening montage sequence to the James Garner movie Grand Prix, where they do all this optical printing, and that's all Saul Bass. But then you look at all these shows that are listed here, and I mean, I watched the Daredevil series on Netflix, and that opening title sequence is just so cool with the sort of the fluid sim and the kind of liquid coming down over the head, and it just creates such an exciting kind of engaging sort of entree into the show. And same with Bosch too. I think what they did with Bosch, where they kind of had things mirroring each other, where they kind of created this symmetry of the highways and stuff. It's such a dynamic and interesting look. The one thing that wasn't on here, which I think is interesting, is the True Detective, which I think the last season's titles are really great. And this season's titles are much better than the show, I think, in season 2.
But, you might be right.
Maybe we'll see those next year.
Yeah,
it seems like True Detective missed the cutoff date.
Yeah.
It came out a little too late or something. So maybe those titles will be available next year. But all of these that are nominated are great examples of what I love about a title sequence, which is you don't feel like, I need to fast forward past this crap. You find something new and it informs the metaphor of the show. Mm-hmm. Like the Daredevil one's a great example of that. I'm always looking at it and studying it to see, like, well, what does it mean? And now that I know more about the show, I'm starting to discover elements that I didn't really notice before. Yeah. Even BoJack Horseman has a really good title sequence in that.
Yeah.
In that respect.
I'd argue that that Bosch is part of the reason I stuck with Bosch is I was totally enamored with that opening sequence. It showed me LA in a way that I've not really seen LA, and I ended up loving that show. I'm so glad there's a second season coming, but until I saw this article, it didn't occur to me how much that title meant from a sort of mental get into it kind of show thing, and it really won me over. So grats to all these guys. I love this kind of stuff anyway. I love, like, company logos, like who did the effects or who's the production company, and Scott Free Productions, which it was Ridley Scott and his deceased brother Tony's production company, and the way that thing's all painterly and cool. Like, I am always in on that stuff. Even Bruckheimer with the lightning and the dude in the field. Like, bring it on, that kind of stuff. So it's nice to see that stuff getting recognized. Very cool.
Loki383 noted the text-based adventure game called The Late Show with Stephen Colbert: Escape from the Man-Sized Cabinet that runs on the Twine engine. The plot involves Stephen Colbert and an escape from a roughly man-sized cabinet.
So this is, the Twine engine's famous for lots of adventure games. It's really good at these games where you've got a screen and your guy walks over and sees something shining in the wall and pulls it out and says, oh, you found a screwdriver, and you put it in your inventory, and later you've got to open a thing and it requires the screwdriver to open it. And, you know, if you played any of those, the Twine engine's really good at that. What's interesting about this is it is the latest in an effort by the new Colbert show, The Late Show, when he takes it over. When is that anyway, by the way? That's soon,
September,
right?
September.
Yeah, a couple months. Right? It's interesting to see them reach out in all these new different ways. Not that, you know, Kimmel and Fallon are doing similar things and have done since the beginning. There's more of an internet focus. There's more of a, let's reach out to this demographic that's not as old as Letterman and Leno were. You know, reach outside the TV grasp and do interesting things. This is just a very unique thing. But when I heard about it, I went, that sounds like something the Colbert people would do. You know, like this fits his MO. This fits his, you know, not his character or any of that, but just kind of his, like, I'm going to reach out to the kids, for lack of a better way of saying it.
And did you guys play the game?
I haven't played it
all the way through.
Did you play it all the way? Oh, yep. Great. What'd you think?
So
it was hilarious.
So that's what I wasn't sure about, because, you know, Twine, like, I teach a game design class at VCU where I teach, and in Twine, I mean, it's like a choose your own adventure. Like, you can create so many different paths that go to different places, and I didn't know if it eventually elliptically looped around to the same end. So I played for a little while. I didn't finish it, but I got myself locked in the cabinet, and I tried to get out by, I was kicking and banging my head against the locked door. And it said that I saw a light in the distance and there was a centaur sleeping. And I thought the coolest, the funniest part was, it said, it asked me if I wanted to, quote unquote, wake the centaur euphemistically, or if I wanted to actually wake him. And so it kept going on and on. But I thought it had the same exact kind of humor, you know, the Stephen Colbert humor. I mean, it was so funny. It's such a great way to kind of connect with fans online.
The real question is, does it give us hints about the format of the show? Because that's the one thing people don't know about, you know?
Not at all.
You don't think so, huh?
Nope. This game does not give you any hints about the format of the
show. Well, and that's what I'm saying.
Other than Stephen Colbert has got funny writers, and it will continue to be funny.
Sure. But my point being that everybody, when he was announced, they were like, well, Wayne, he's leaving behind his Colbert character.
Right,
and
we know that. Yeah. He's not going to be the fake talk show host that he was on the Colbert Report.
So I just wonder if all this web stuff he's done and now this, if anyone can glean from any of this what the tone will be. I don't know. It's hard to say.
My best guess was when he went on the local Michigan community television show on the, like, you know, public access show, that maybe he would try to attempt to approach Late Show as if it were a community access show.
Well, when he did the Eminem interview, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that made me kind of hope he was, but then I thought that's pretty a daring idea if that's what he's going to do. I don't think we have any hints. I don't think we have any idea. I think it'll be good. He's got great writers. He's bringing his best people with him. He's a really funny guy. I was a giant Letterman fan, so any transition is going to be a little shocking to my system, but I really want it to be good. So I guess he really is a
great choice for a replacement, though. Mm-hmm. If you had to pick somebody, I think he's top shelf all the way.
Yeah,
for
I agree.
Yeah. Finally, Jeff Rose wants us to talk about the reboot of Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah.
That's in development at NBC. It has original producers Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert attached. Apparently, they want to do a modern reboot, start airing in 2016. And according to The Hollywood Reporter, the new Xena will be a blend of Lucy Lawless's original version and Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games.
Oh, I don't know about that last part. But I'll say this. Sam Raimi, real busy with TV again. He's almost going back to his roots. He's got his Evil Dead show on Stars. That looks really interesting. Saw the trailer for that. And now this. It's like he's, I don't know. It's like he's turned on the movie business and said, I'm going to go back to what I did in the 90s. And I think I'm okay with it. I'm cool with it. What do you think, Matt, about the future of Xena, the Warrior Princess?
Okay, so I have to confess, I've never watched Xena, Warrior Princess. It's a safe space,
Matt. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
You can say it here. You're among friends. It's fine.
Yeah. But maybe I'll have to check it out though. If they actually do a reboot, I'll see if I can be enticed to watch a little Xena action.
It was in that.
I had forgotten until I read this article that Xena was a spinoff. It was a spinoff of Hercules, but it was so much more popular than Hercules ever got.
That's true. They were both birthed in that era of syndicated original television, which I don't really think exists in quite the same way as it used to. That you had Star
Trek.
What
are you talking about?
What do we have today that's like this?
Golden age
of syndicated TV.
Well, what do you mean by maybe it's the syndicated part?
That's the part that's weird to me. So back in the day, let's say the 90s, you had like TNG, DS9, these shows we're talking about.
So you're just saying they weren't on networks. They were on local independent.
Correct. Right? They were distributed. They were syndicated the way that, say, Seinfeld.
The arrival of UPN and the WB networks eliminated all of that.
Do you think that's what
it brought? And then they unified as UPN. Or wait, was it the CW? Brought them together, and so now there's not enough budget in independent television, and all the independent TV stations have all aligned with somebody at this point anyway.
Yeah, there's not much need, and you've got channels like AMC and FX and others willing.
That's
to
what
do.
I thought. I was like, wait, there's original television like crazy, Scott. What are you talking about? But I didn't think about the syndicated part.
Sure. The whole Stargate thing. And, you know, all that stuff existed in this weird bubble that isn't needed anymore,
Stargate,
I guess.
Stargate was Showtime, wasn't it?
It started on Showtime and
then
ended
it went
up,
to Sci-Fi Network?
Then it went to full
Or did it go full
syndication? That could be...
But you're right. We don't really have syndication.
Not really.
Other than reruns. Reruns get syndicated.
Sure. You have some things on pay-per-view that are sort of like that, but that's pay-per-view, which is a very different thing. So yeah,
Do you think that it matters that we don't have syndication since we have all of these cable networks? Is that why we don't have it?
Yeah, I think it's completely useless now. And the fact that not only is there all these cable networks, now there's streaming solutions, Amazon and Netflix doing original programming. Like, what would even be the point? In fact, if anything, Netflix has become the new home for syndicated specials and programming in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And people know how to, I think young people really, especially, they know how to find what they want to see,
Yeah. I mean, it just used to be, you had to, if you wanted to see Star Trek TNG brand new episode season 6, you had to be on whatever your local channel 30 thing.
Right. Like when it first came on, there was no UPN. Uh-uh. I think it was on channel 11. In St. Louis. It might have been 30, though. I don't remember for sure.
Some 30 or maybe something else here. And it was just some local weird channel that did all the syndicated shows. And then UPN came and launched, if you'll remember, with Star Trek Voyager. That was like their big flagship.
Right.
And then that didn't really work out great. I mean, it was okay. The show was all right. But it's not like it benefited from being on a network, really, more than it would have if it was syndicated. But I don't know. There's something about that I kind of miss. And I don't know why. It's probably just pure... just a pure drop of nostalgia for a different time when programming was weird, but
when Dawson's Creek ruled the airwaves.
Yeah.
See, I feel like I'm even more old school though. Like they have a, I think it's all across the country now, but there's a, I think it's called MeTV. Mm. And I love turning that on. I can watch like Linda Carter as Wonder Woman and Lindsay Wagner as the Bionic Woman. Like that's kind of more my speed, I think, than the Xena. I like that throwback.
Maybe that's the new thing. I mean, it's kind of like what TV Land used to be, although lately it's more original programming, but it's just a place for all these old syndicated reruns. And I like that too. Like there's an action one. What's that called? There's a channel like me.tv or MeTV, but it's something else. Anyway, it's all action all the time, and it's like a local cable thing. And it's like Hawaii 5-0, the old one, Rockford Files, like that kind of stuff all day long. Yeah. All detective shows all the time from the 70s and 80s. That is really great. Like the fact that that's still a thing you can turn on and not pre-program or get a bunch of metadata or skip episodes, something you just sit down and consume in that way is kind of awesome. I'm glad.
Well, that's kind of the thing. All those old shows, like from way, way back, like, I mean, there's so much content, and some of that stuff is, some of it you can find, but a lot of it's kind of piecemeal. It's hard to get your hands on it. And it'd be so cool to be able to have access to even go sort of to the Wayback Machine and see some of those older programs.
Yeah.
I think that's why something like MeTV, which is usually like a secondary digital broadcast channel, I think they work because all of the shows they're showing were built in the era when you didn't have a recording. And so they were built to be jumped into without having seen previous week's episodes or next week's episodes. And so they still work in that milieu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Different time, different place. Yeah. But I'll tell you what's next. Hold on. I thought I had a thing ready here. Yeah, oh. Hey, it's the pop quiz right here.
America scores and wins.
All right. Oh, great. Why won't that move? There we go. All right, sorry. A few technical glitches here. We're going to do the pop quiz as a chance for our listeners to hear our guest be challenged with questions in their areas of expertise. I haven't let Matt know what his category is, but I think it's one he'll excel at. And we're going to find out shortly. I'm just trying to get your test up here. Here we go. Pop quiz. There you are. All right. This is your category. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Oh, by the way, if you get it right, if you get it wrong, Tom scores the entire thing, and we'll see how you do. Yours is movie special effects.
Oh, okay. Cool.
In your area of expertise.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds all right. So it's kind of all over the map in terms of what and where and what, but here it is. First question. What household object was used to simulate snow during the Battle of Hoth?
A flour sifter.
You are, you are correct, but what is in the sifter?
Oh.
The stuff that makes the snow itself as it's falling.
Baking soda?
You are correct. Nicely done.
2 points.
Is that a common thing?
Double point.
Yeah, double point.
You know, I don't know. I just guessed.
All right. Well, see?
I'm in the digital age of effects. I wish I was in the practical age, but...
Well,
he actually is a composite created by like 30-person team.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not even here right now.
Yeah, this isn't even you. Number next. Here you go. How many visual effects vendors worked on Mad Max?
I hope I didn't accidentally just give it away.
One.
You are incorrect. It was 10 separate house of visual effects.
Oh, houses. I should have known that. I didn't do that VFX show. So
I love that movie. Yeah, according to the visual effects supervisor on the Avengers, what did Joss Whedon request be added to Iron Man's suit?
I don't know. Maybe some a way to go to the bathroom. Maybe. A port.
Close. A jetpack is the correct answer. According to the trivia, Whedon did not like the Tinkerbell pose during scenes of Iron Man in flight. So they wanted to add a jetpack.
I think that would be kind of cute, the Tinkerbell pose. Well, that might look kind of nice.
Can't get Whedon to back off his ideas. Next up, according to the IMDb trivia, what was the most difficult effect to pull off in Jurassic Park? This would be the 1993 original.
The most difficult effect in the original Jurassic Park to pull off, according to IMDb, would have been the night attack on the road.
You
with
are
the T-Rex.
Oh, you know what, Tom? You're gonna have to tell me on this one.
Because I thought it was making Jeff Goldblum look human. But
so here's the actual answer, and then I feel like it might be in the territory. So I'll tell you the answer before I give you a buzzer or ding here. The vibrating rings of water. Michael and Terry found this very difficult. The effect was achieved by putting vibrating guitar strings under a dashboard in the car to create those rings of water, which was during the night attack.
Yeah, I think you get a 3/4 point for that.
All right, we'll give you that one. That was a good one.
Round up. Right. Yeah.
How much does James Cameron claim Avatar would have cost if they made the film in 99 due to the effects being much more expensive to produce then?
Wow. $200 million.
Very, very close. Well, not really. $400
million. Well, then a half point because he got half of it right.
All right. Oh, cool.
Nicely done. All right.
Yeah.
Next up, how many weeks did it take to create all the visual effects in Tron Legacy?
How many weeks?
Yeah, how many weeks? That's a terrible question.
Tron Legacy. Simonis. I don't know. Maybe 47 weeks.
68 weeks.
Oh,
wow.
A long time. Yeah, long time for a movie that wasn't that great. Next up, I made me sad because I love Tron.
They blew it in that one. You know, they could have made it cooler. It didn't have all the cool, like, bit and RAM and all the kind of inside computer stuff. That would have made it more
I would have been more interested in a straight-up remake, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
That would have been good.
Like an actual RAM.
Yeah.
Like a sheep.
Yeah,
like a male
sheep. Yeah. Little digital RAM.
Digital RAM.
Second to last question. When was Digital Weta or Weta Digital founded?
Oh, boy. 1996?
Oh, 3 years off. 1993 is the correct answer. Oh. Seems early, though.
A third of a point, then.
That seems early to me. Oh, well, whatever. Here's your final question.
I thought it was the second age. Man.
Third robotic rule or whatever. Who was the visual effects supervisor on Gravity?
Oh, shoot. I should know.
Everyone knows that was shot on location, Scott.
He won all kinds of Oscar business for this guy.
Yeah. I don't know. Elon Musk. I don't know. It's wrong.
Elon Musk. Nice one. It was Tim Weber. Tim Weber. And no, that...
I wouldn't have got that.
That ends your questioning. A difficult, broad range of effects questions. Tom,
Iceworm was not taking it easy.
No, he laid India. How do you do?
You ended up with a total of 53.58.
Oh, because of the 50-point bonus at the top of the show.
Yeah, came in with 50 on the Gavel McLeod thing.
I think you're ahead of everyone we've ever had on the show. So
you say that every week, Scott.
Do I?
It may be true every week. I'm not disputing it. I'm just...
I'll see if I can crash and burn and lose a few, like, sort of outside the tail end of the game here.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Time for this.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
It's time for Forecast. It used to be a show. It's now a segment where we try to predict the future in technology, pop culture, or whatever tickles our fancy. Tom's fancy was tickled in this particular day. What do we got?
So I was reading the Scientific American article about the ability to estimate the information storage capacity of the universe. Mm. If we could put a bit in every atom, and there was some talk about the information storage capacity of the Earth, and how we are a very small amount, as much information as we store. Of what could possibly be stored if we used every atom on Earth. Anyway, so it got me thinking that down the road, the value of a machine is not going to be specs. Because I started thinking about in the more practical terms about storage capacity. I'm like, no, we are going to get better at creating the ability to store more and more and more. And as we've seen with processors, at a certain point, we can make a processor that's faster than we need. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really worry as much about processor speed anymore. At a certain point, we're going to make RAM bigger than we need and storage bigger than we need. And at some point, instead of looking at the specs of the performance of the elements, when we buy a machine, the value of a machine will become its ability to understand data. And not just on the software, but like the hardware capacity to be able to make sense of data. The spec we look at could be something like a comprehension score or a predictive ability or some such thing.
Mm, interesting. So, wow, I like that. We're already at that point. I remember Google somewhat famously predicted when they launched the original Gmail beta that they were just going to keep adding storage to that because they were betting on this idea. I was talking to Will Smith about this, betting on this idea that one day storage would be virtually free.
Right.
And that's kind of come to fruition. If you're a big company doing big cloud stuff, the cost is not in the storage. The cost is in, services and software and things that pull from the storage. But the storage itself is, by most accounts, practically free. And the idea that we could somehow get to a point... I love this idea about storing things in space for some reason. That's sticking in my head. But the idea about moving all that we know and do into a near infinite place, and then all that's left is for our existing, like, imagine the existing processors we have today, which by all accounts, it's, you're less and less needing a new computer upgrade every other year like we used to be.
Yeah, it's true.
It takes a lot longer, right, Matt? I mean, like, if I want to replace my desktop, I'm 5-6 years instead of the 2 or 3 maybe that I tried to stretch it before. So why not have that stuff, do what it already does well and do it in a way that answers Tom's call for action here. What do you think?
Well, I'm just reading. I mean, just reading the quote too, like, it almost feels like, you're talking about like a certain level of maybe a slightly more sophisticated than we have now, a kind of an AI, it's about like, what can the machine, predict? What can it know? How much can it actually comprehend, there's already so much of that kind of stuff, whether it's, a personal assistant in like a smartphone or, a search engine or whatever, but being able to kind of get something like that, to increase, if you're start thinking of, I keep thinking for some reason of Watson, when he was on Jeopardy or whatever, like that kind of predictive ability and his ability to, understand and respond to a question in a reasonably, quick amount of time. I mean, that sort of becomes, or even what's that thing? It's sort of a different concept maybe, but it's kind of in the same zone. But that, what's that Amazon thing called that you?
Oh, the Echo? Echo.
Alexis or
The Echo, where you say Alexa.
And Alexa, add chocolate chips to shopping list.
Exactly. But I mean, there's something about that too, though. I mean, it's kind of corny, but at the same time too, like the integration of that into, you know, the larger context of your, you know, quote unquote machine, could become really valuable.
Oh yeah. No, I agree. I mean, what are our brains other than a lot of storage capacity and then a few interfaces that interface with that data and turn it into something useful. So why not?
Yeah.
I like that idea a lot. Tom, you've predicted the future once again.
I also added chocolate chips to TVZ God's shopping list just now. Sorry about that, Greg. I do think though, that at a certain point, the specs just become better than we can take advantage of. And the trends have shown that will continue to happen. And so, yeah, I just entertained maybe by the idea of like, instead of saying, my machine's too slow, I need to upgrade, to be like, my machine's too dumb, I need to upgrade.
Right. I like that a lot.
It just isn't capable of getting any smarter.
This reminds me of a dream I had once where we figured out a way to store data, like actual computer data, in our bodies, like in cells. So you would touch the interface of a computer and like a USB drive or whatever, data would be transferred to your physiology and would stay there as long as you were alive, and you could move it from one computer to another. And they were just our computers. It wasn't like any fancy interface. It was just like, I would touch this little logo and it would say, it's photos found. They were stored in your clavicle all week. You know, like that's a cool, that's a cool idea too, but it's also a weird dream. And it involved Martians and some other stuff that I don't want to talk about. Yeah. And my clavicle. We also get feedback here on the show. They come to us via email at currentgeek@gmail.com. Also, some of you sometimes are brave enough to leave a voicemail, 801-471-0462. We got an email from Stephanie. She wrote in and says, "Hi, guys. Stephanie here from Washington State, and I have a question. Do you think we'd think Back to the Future or the original Star Wars or even Star Trek would be cool if we only saw it for the first time now? Jurassic World's a fun movie, but it's not even close to the original. But ask a 10-year-old that question. They think it's the best movie they've ever seen ever. Feeling old in Olympia, Stephanie."
Olympia, it's the water.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of what we were talking about, you know, kind of earlier on too. I think the, I mean, I have an 11-year-old son, and like, you know, he, to my total dismay, like I was like a total Star Wars fan, like growing up as a kid, and he's just not into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so brutal.
And you can't force them to do it, can you? You can't force it down. They have to.
Totally.
They either like it or they don't. Yeah.
But a lot of young people. I was like, oh, wait, what's the cable guy or the milkman or something? Right. But no, Back to the Future and Star Wars and even the old, although my son does love the original Star Trek TV series. So he still thinks that's really cool. And, you know, he was super bummed when Leonard Nimoy passed away this last year. And but I think, you know, a lot of kids see the original Star Wars and Back to the Future, and they do think it's really cool, even if they're seeing it for the first time, you know, a movie that was made in the 80s or a movie that was made back in the late 70s or even a TV show that was made in the 60s. I think it just depends really on the temperament and on the person who sees it and maybe the context in which they experience it, you know, whether or not they're going to think it's, you know, the kind of, whether or not it resonates in the way that maybe it resonated for some of us of a more advanced age.
It's just people 30 to 50, they all think they know why this stuff was the greatest thing ever. And if they make remakes, why it's a terrible atrocity, and that people don't appreciate why Back to the Future was such a seminal work. But if you go back to 85, if I wasn't 14, if I was, I don't know, if I was some 35-year-old banker, I probably would have thought, oh, that's a dumb movie about time travel. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much age plays into it.
There's taste differences no matter when and where or who, right? But at the same time, there are plenty of movies from the 40s that I love, you know, and I am out of context, right? I was not born in the 40s, despite my beard's appearance. I think some people can still like things that are older. Another way to approach Stephanie's question, though, is like, imagine if Back to the Future had never come out,
yeah,
right? There was never any Back to the Future. We had no movie like it. And they made it today. So forget the datedness of effects. Forget the, you know, the references. They make it 2015, Back to the Future. Is that concept for the movie still going to resonate with you? Are you still going to love that idea of the movie?
Yeah. And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you would, though. I mean, I don't know. I sort of felt like, and this was a radical statement, but I sort of thought Guardians of the Galaxy was, in my mind, seeing it now, like, I think it was so much like, in terms of its tone and sort of its, I don't know, kind of that sort of the Western, but yet this light comedy, but big special effects and kind of a touching story, cool characters. It was a lot like the original Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I feel like I said that to some of my friends and it was like blasphemy or something. But it was one of those things where, to me, it had so much of those same components, and that formula still was really successful and still worked. So, I mean, you know, that's a tough one. Like, it's such an ephemeral thing. It's hard to kind of nail down what specifically would be different. Obviously, the actors would be different. Maybe the effects would be different, what have you. But like the formulaic structure. And there are still a lot of really interesting time travel movies. I'm trying to think of the name of that one where those kids find that camera that can take a picture of like the next day or the day before.
Yeah. What was that called?
The camera?
No. Yeah, the camera.
So many movies like that are just named obvious.
Well, you said something though, Matt, that totally rings true to me. The formula, the hard truth is that we're going to have to face this one day, is the formula is just the same. Like the human beings all really like the same structural storytelling, and we like some of the same beats and the same tropes.
You like the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah, and stuff like, gets repackaged.
Kind
and
of
re-
only two stories.
Yeah,
really.
You get reskinned and repackaged, and you just get the same thing again. And I think I'm fine with that. It's fine. It's going to be a little tweaked, a little better. It's going to, you know, we're better at making them now. Like, you know, Guardians looks a whole lot better than anything like it from my era growing up. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. I think I'm okay with it now. I no longer, and like people freaking out about Ghostbusters being remade with a bunch of ladies in it. It's fine. It's going to be great. In fact, you know what? More power to you to give me something I haven't already seen before. Let me see something a little bit new.
I'm curious if I'll live long enough. I don't think I will. But someday, someone will remake the original Star Wars.
Yeah, probably. And there'll be, will anyone be here to be mad? I wonder.
No, I'll be dead.
No, I don't mean dead. Like, I mean, will there be a generation that cares as much as we do?
Or do you mean people? No, the humanity will have exterminated itself.
The only thing left is a big empty theater with a movie.
Yeah.
Remake.
It's the robots who will remake it.
Yeah. I don't know. I just, we recycle everything and it's fine. Everyone should just start to get to reconcile with that and be okay with it. It wasn't like we invented it, and just live with what it is and it's fine. Remake it. Do what you got to do. Thanks for the email, Stephanie, and anyone else who sends us emails. Again, currentgeek@gmail.com is where to send those. And that marks the end of this fine podcast. Now, Matt, we'd like you to tell us where they can find more about you, our listeners.
Well, you can find anything and everything you want to know about me at, let's see, Virginia Commonwealth University, where I am an associate professor in the School of the Arts. Mm. I teach computer graphics and computer animation. I have a website, mattwallen.com. I'm on the VFX Show podcast, where we talk about all things visual effects, and we get like way geekier and way nerdier. I should say maybe way nerdier, not geekier necessarily, but nerdier than you guys get here, where we kind of delve deep into like technical specifics about how something was done, and we critique the success or failure of those effects. And that's at effectsguide.com. And then I have my own website, which is mattwallen.com.
Nice. People should go check
that
out.
Do we still see your name in credits too if we spy out?
The last big project I worked on was The Watchmen. And so since then, because I'm now a dad, and teaching kind of is more conducive to to being a parent than the nomadic life of a visual effects artist.
Yeah, the 25-hour-a-day. I totally get that. Did you? Yep. So were you responsible? I have to ask the question, and I apologize in advance. But were you on the team responsible for the big blue penis?
No, that was I could I wish I were. No,
I was quite a thing on the, to hang your name on. Yeah,
I was on a different team.
Great, Scott, you've reminded of one of his great regrets.
I did once work on a Woody Allen movie. I worked on the movie Celebrity.
Yeah,
and one of the jobs I had in that was no joke, was to remove a booger.
Oh wow!
From the nose of an actor.
And you can't tell us what actor, can you?
Booger removal.
And you won't tell us who. We have to guess as to who it was, right? The actor. I mean,
look for the actor without a booger.
All right.
No, I guess whoever's booger free. But no, I didn't. Sony Pictures, Sony Imageworks worked on the Big Blue Dr. Manhattan character for that project, and I was working for a company who opened an office in Vancouver, and they were part of a British company called the Moving Picture Company, and we worked on a bunch of other sequences in the show.
Someone had to take a bunch of time and model a dude's wiener. That's all I'm saying. That had to happen.
Hey, it happens.
And animated and everything else. Physics, right, exactly. Well, it was great having you on, man. Thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Thomas, anything you'd like to mention?
Yeah. I usually say, hey, I wrote this book, Citadel 32, and if you'd like a quick read about kind of a post-apocalyptic people on the moon, people down on Earth story, go check it out. And some of you have. So all I want to say today is, if you have, go review it on Amazon for me. Andrew Main told me I should tell people that. So that's what I'm doing.
Hmm. Well, he's done a few books. He knows what's
he's
up.
He's a published author with a real publishing house.
Yeah, that guy knows what's up.
Yeah.
Very cool. That book's great.
It has to meet the queen or something to make that happen.
And don't forget, if you're traveling to Nerdtacular 2015 here in Salt Lake City at the Snowbird Resort, that's next weekend. If you're coming up for that, bring your copy of that book if you've purchased it, if you have the physical one, and Tom and I will sign it. I'll sign it because I did the cover, and Tom will sign it because he wrote the damn thing.
I will sign it in anyone's name, too. Tell me which.
That's right. Oh, and a reminder, if you want to see all this stuff live from that event, we'll have cameras in every panel. For the full 2 days, and you can catch it, details about it, where to watch it, how to listen, all that stuff over at frogpants.com/live. And that includes our current geek episode, so watch for that. That's going to do it for us. Big thanks to Matthew. Thanks, Matt.
Matthew again. Oxley at MatthewOxley.com.
I did totally
and Paul Swickard, our intern who does the show notes.
Oh my gosh. It's almost like I do these two same shows on a Friday. Weird. Andrew Allen did our theme music. That's who I meant to say. So he's awesome. Go check his stuff out. Alpha Geek Radio for our live audio. Thanks for that. Give us a call. Leave us a message, 801-471-0462. At Current Geek on Twitter. Oh gosh, what else? At Scott Johnson, at Ace Detect, currentgeek.reddit.com, currentgeek@gmail.com, currentgeek.com for everything. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for Matt. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. Before we get started, if you're coming to Nerdtacular, so am I. Please say hello to me while you're there. This week we take a look at a recent Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that may change the way online retailers do business. The case was Multi-Time Machine versus Amazon. Multi-Time Machine makes high-end military-style watches under certain brand names and trademarks, like MTM Special Ops. Because MTM closely controls its own distribution, these watches are not available at places like Amazon. However, when consumers type in MTM Special Ops Watch or similar searches into Amazon's search system, the internal search engine returns a list of other multifunction watches from MTM's competitors, but no statement is made that Amazon does not carry MTM watches. The only difference from other online retailers is that Amazon does not explicitly respond first with a statement that MTM watches are not available on Amazon. When MTM sued Amazon for trademark infringement, citing consumer confusion in this process, the Federal District Court ruled in favor of Amazon. But the appeals court reversed this decision, with a 2-1 majority revitalizing a doctrine called initial interest confusion. This is a trademark doctrine that was thought dead in most jurisdictions, but the Ninth Circuit defined it as follows. Initial interest confusion occurs not at the time of purchase, but earlier in the shopping process, if the consumer confusion creates initial interest in a competitor product. If that definition sounds ridiculous, it's because it is. That would cover many other clearly legitimate and long-accepted retailing practices, such as selling house-branded products with similar labeling adjacent to name-brand products. The dissenting judge put it best when he responded that the search results page makes clear to anyone who can read English that Amazon only carries the brands of watches that are clearly and explicitly listed on the webpage. So apparently the fluffy doctrine of initial interest consumer confusion still lives, which means this zombie doctrine could come back to bite unsuspecting litigants. What's most disappointing is that this case is better formulated as a bait-and-switch false advertising claim, if anything, but the Ninth Circuit validated the trademark claim by making the law bend to the facts. The bottom line is, trademark law serves the interests of business owners and consumers, but it does have reasonable limits. When it doesn't, as in this case, it harms businesses trying to help consumers, as well as consumers in the long run. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions as segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.